Macmillan Audio presents Nomad by James Swallow. Read for you by Colin Mace.
One. The day was coming to an end, but still the heat fell like hammers. Barcelona shimmered as if it were a mirage, the air lensed by the warmth of the day escaping from the narrow streets back into the cloudless sky. As he walked, Pasco patted his shoulder with a rolled-up copy of El Periódico, tapping out an aimless rhythm across the top of his sergeant's chevrons. His uniform shirt was sticking to his barrel chest, but he didn't notice it. Pasco was a son of this city, fourth generation, and he'd grown up in the Balearic sunshine. His old face attested to that. Careworn, like good calfskin leather. He navigated around the knots of tourists and locals without really being aware of it. The uniform did most of the work for him. The pale blue of the Mossos d'Esquadra and the red banded cap on his head, cutting a path through people on the busy street. Now that the sun had dropped below the rooftops, the first wave of revelers were shaking off their siesta and coming out to play. Joining them were pale Germans and paler British, yet to build up a tolerance to the heat and grateful for the cooling atmosphere and the open-air cafes in this part of the old town. Minor criminals, pickpockets, and opportunist thieves would already be among them. But few would be found near this corner of the Ciutat Vella district, thanks to the imposing slab-sided shape of the main police station on the Nou de la Rambla. It was a charmless building, all heavy white stone and blue-tinted glass, built with the modernist ethic that had swept over the city in the last few decades. He crossed the station's courtyard, passing Enrique going the other way, and the two policemen exchanged nods. Enrique pointed at the newspaper. "Hey, Abelo, finish it today?" He smiled, showing tobacco-stained teeth. Pasco snapped open the paper with a flourish. It was a little ritual that they shared once a week, when the cryptic crossword was published. He offered it to Enrique to show him that every clue had been filled in, the letters written in a careful hand. The younger man scowled. Pasco knew the other sergeant hadn't completed the puzzle himself, which meant that Enrique would be required to buy him a packet of the good cigarillos, as their regular competition demanded.
"You've got better all of a sudden?" Enrique asked, with no little suspicion.
Pasco gave a shrug.
"The warm air makes me smarter."
Enrique's scowl deepened.
"If I catch you cheating, I will fill your desk with cat shit."
He gave a rueful smile of defeat and walked on. Pasco snorted. Soon, perhaps in a week or two, after he had made up enough wins to redress the lead Enrique had on him, he would reveal his secret. A birthday gift from his grandson. An electronic gadget that kept all his names and addresses, birth dates and phone numbers. It was a clever thing, packed with a huge library of words and phrases in different languages, and it had come in useful more than once when Pasco had found himself dealing with foreign tourists. It also had a dictionary in it that was excellent at suggesting whole words when you only had a few letters to go on. Thinking about the boy made him think about his son, and guilt stirred in his chest. He was supposed to call him yesterday, but after work, a few of the men went to the local bar, and he had lost the rest of the evening with his colleagues and their rough good humor. Pasco sighed. His son worried about him now that his mother was with the angels.
"Papa, a man like you should not be walking the streets," he would say. "Policeman is a job for men of my age, not yours. Let them give you a desk."
A desk. The very idea made Pasco's heart shrink in his chest. He loved this city, like it was his own private property. And to see it from behind a desk day in and day out. His son didn't understand that it would be a slow death for him, slow and hard, like the cancer that had taken his beautiful Rosa. Through the glass doors into the precinct hall, a steady mutter of conversation and office noise washed over him. Stepping through the arches of the metal detectors, he nodded absently to the man on duty there as the scanner bleated. The other police officer waved him through with a distracted nod. Pasco doffed his cap, and he tried to push his thoughts of family aside. There were bigger problems for Pasco to deal with. Sometimes, his son seemed like he had come from another planet, with all his talk of things like the global warming that made the summer heat murderous, the scandals of the impossibly rich, and the men of other countries who seemed to kill each other for reasons Pasco couldn't begin to fathom. He sighed. It was because of those things that he didn't buy the paper for the news anymore. All too depressing. It was just a crossword now, and nothing else. Pasco noticed the boy then, and chided himself for being too deep in his own head. There was no reason not to remain observant. The youth was in his late teens, but the pallor of his face made it difficult to be certain exactly how old he was. He had a heavy brow and dark eyes filled with worry. The ends of black curls peeked out from under a tan painter's cap. The rest of him hidden inside a nondescript tracksuit the color of tilled earth. He walked like his training shoes were too tight for him, stepping awkwardly as he made his way toward the big desk where Thomas, the duty officer, was growling something at a junior mosso. The youth became aware of Pasco looking directly at him and flinched as if he had been struck. The sergeant got a good look at him then, head on. He was washed out, filmed with sweat, and there was a line of bruising on his neck. His eyes, though, were what caught Pasco. The teenager's eyes were so very serious, in that way that only the young were capable of. He saw his son and his grandson in them. The youth in the tracksuit gave him an owlish look, as if he was going to say something, and then his legs bent under him. He landed hard on the tiled floor and skidded. People heard the impact, the heavy noise of it echoing in the hall, and they turned to stare. Pasco was immediately at the teenager's side, kneeling down to look him over. He looked ill. Not like a junkie dragged through withdrawal, but someone afflicted with a sort of bone-deep sickness that ate away at a person.
"Are you all right, boy?" asked the sergeant. "What's the matter? Do you need a doctor?"
The look Pasco got in return told him that the youth didn't understand a word of Spanish. Part of his mind, the trained, focused part of him that was pure police, was already evaluating the boy, thinking of him in terms of how he would be logged and reported in the day's paperwork.
"Where are you from?"
he asked the question without thinking about it. The silent youth looked back with his serious eyes. The sergeant cast around and found a familiar face in the yellow and orange of a paramedic's jacket.
"Noya!"
he shouted the girl's name, but she was already on her way to him, the toolbox shape of an emergency kit in her gloved hand. Noya was a regular at the precinct. The petite Catalan girl was part of an ambulance crew from the local hospital, and more often than not, when a medical crisis arose at the station, her team was the one that answered the call. Pasco liked her, even though a lot of the other men didn't. She was brisk and severe, but fiercely competent.
"Help me get him over to a bench," she demanded.
Between them, they helped the youth stagger to a wooden seat in the waiting area. The paramedic, yelling at the people, sat upon it to vacate. They scattered, and Pasco laid the boy down. His breathing changed, coming in short gasps like a frightened animal. The level of noise in the entrance hall dropped as people began to notice what was going on, pausing in the middle of their own little dramas to watch the unfolding of this one. Some were coming closer to get a better look. Noya snapped her fingers to attract the youth's attention.
Hey, can you hear me?
I don't think he understands, Pasco told her.
She had her fingers at his neck, checking his pulse.
It's not heat stroke, Noya replied.
She reached for the zipper of his tracksuit jacket, and the boy snatched at it, preventing the paramedic from opening it. A new emotion crept into his eyes. Fear. He tried to speak, but all that came out was a dry gasp.
I need to open your shirt, Noya said sternly.
She waggled a stethoscope at him.
To listen.
She was speaking loudly and over-enunciating each word, as if talking to a slow child. The youth looked past her to Pasco, and again he tried to say something. Licking dry lips, he forced out a word, and the effort seemed to cost him. The sergeant only caught part of it, and he leaned in. The boy tried again, and this time Pasco heard the whisper clearly.
Shaiden.
The word meant nothing to him. He frowned.
Get back, Noya snapped at Pasco. Don't crowd me.
She tried to grab the zipper, and again the youth resisted her. She scowled.
I don't have time for this.
The paramedic pulled an ingot of bright orange plastic from her pocket. A rescue tool. It was typically used for cutting the seatbelts off victims of traffic accidents. But Noya could wield it like a surgeon, and with a single swift motion, she hooked it in the tracksuit collar and sliced it open. Pasco did as he was told, falling back a step or two, giving Noya room to work. Her partner, a skinny Portuguese lad, came across the hall with a folding stretcher in one hand. The youth said the word again, and without thinking about it, Pasco pulled out his birthday gift and thumbed the tab marked translator. As best he could, he repeated what he had heard into the device's pinhole microphone. It would not have been an exaggeration to say that Jadid's room was the most expensive space he had ever been in. The executive suite on the upper floor of the Hilton was alien to him in a way he found difficult to articulate. It wasn't something he would have spoken about to the other men, for fear that they might be amused by it and consider him parochial and unworldly. He didn't like to be thought of as inferior. But the suite could quite easily have encompassed the entire footprint of the slum apartment in Jeddah, where he had grown up. The first night, he had not been able to sleep in the huge soft bed, interrupted by dreams of being swamped in a vast empty space. He took sheets and made a place instead in the living room, arranged in the lee of a long sofa where he wouldn't be seen by someone entering the doorway. It served him much better. Jadid sipped from a tumbler of water as he crossed the room toward one of the floor-to-ceiling windows. It seemed wrong to him that so much space should account for the needs of a single person. He felt that in his bones, as if it were a violation of some kind of law.
It was wasteful, but then it was Western.
At the open window, he felt more comfortable. A low moon was already visible in the sky, and lights were coming on across Barcelona, all along the Diagonal Mar and out toward the city center. Sounds reached up to him from 16 floors below, where restaurant terraces in the shopping mall across the street were taking in their early evening business. He sat before a low table and lit one of the Czech cigarettes that were his sole vice, taking a long draw. He tossed the match into a glass ashtray before exhaling a cloud of blue smoke. Next to the ashtray were a pair of compact but powerful Bushnell binoculars, a wireless headset, and the flat, glassy tile of a smartphone. Jadid nudged the phone with his finger, turning it idly in a circle where it lay. Although the device outwardly resembled any one of a number of next-generation handsets, it had been heavily modified. Beneath the brushed aluminium surface, there was barely a single component still in place from the original design. Jadid remained suspicious of the technology, but more intelligent men than he had told him it was safe to use, and he knew enough not to question. The smartphone buzzed, and he blinked in surprise. Stubbing out the cigarette, he hooked the lozenge-shaped headset's loop over his right ear and tapped the phone's screen. The panel immediately illuminated with a number of coloured icons and an oscillating display showing the rise and fall of a single waveform. He heard a resonant voice in his ear.
I am watching.
Kadir's words were strong and clear, almost as if he was standing at Jadid's shoulder. Only the ghostly whisper of static beneath them betrayed the fact that the man on the other end of the line was thousands of miles away. There was a fractional delay. Doubtless some artifact of the complex course taken by the call's clandestine routing around the globe and back via satellite relay, through encryption filters at both ends. Jadid nodded.
Very soon now.
He reached for the binoculars and scanned the rooftops. He quickly found his sightline. After a moment, he looked away to the smartphone, carefully tapping one of the application icons. It grew into a window containing a countdown clock, and Jadid watched the numbers tumble toward zero. Kadir would be looking at the exact same display. The clock reached the 2-minute mark and blinked red.
120 seconds, muttered the voice. We are committed.
Jadid smiled slightly.
Has there ever been a moment when that was not so?
Kadir didn't rise to the comment.
Were there any issues with the sample before deployment?
He glanced down at the fingers of his right hand. They were still a little red and inflamed from where he had been forced to use them to inflict a moment of discipline, wrapping the steel spheres of his Misbahar prayer beads into a tight loop like a knuckle duster.
No.
He lied. Silence answered him, and he reluctantly amended his reply.
Nothing of note.
If Kadir heard the pause in his voice, he didn't comment on it.
I appreciate you handling this personally, he said. You understand that I need eyes I trust to witness this. Of course.
The fact was, there were many men that Kadir could have given this assignment to. Men they would have been more than willing to leave to take the blame after the fact. But this was too important to be left to inferiors.
I have my departure arranged.
Jadid had paid for the room for another day, but he would be leaving it in little more than... He glanced at the smartphone. Only 60 seconds now. The binoculars came up again and found their mark.
This is what the Americans would call... The moment of truth, said Jadid, almost to himself.
How apt, offered Kadir.
The boy tried to stop Noya, but his effort was weak and half-hearted, as if he couldn't muster the energy to do it. He moaned as Noya pressed the disc of the stethoscope to his chest. Her other hand moved lightly over the youth's torso. Stubby fingers clad in blue latex probing at his flesh. Each touch got another pained reaction. The paramedic swore under her breath and bunched a handful of the boy's T-shirt in her fist, and she bared his chest with another slice of the cutter. Pasco heard her partner gasp. He actually heard the sound of the Portuguese recoiling in that sharp breath, the man's face twisting. He knew that expression too of disgust and horror, being swiftly shut away beneath a professional facade of detachment. One of the tourists, watching the scene unfold, made a gagging noise and went ashen. Pasco was compelled to take a look at the boy, and he regretted it immediately, crossing himself as he realized what had been done to him.
Santa Maria.
Suddenly he felt his age, right there in the marrow of his bones, heavy like lead. It disappointed him to think that someone could inflict such horrors as the young man had suffered. A soft digital ping brought his attention back to the electronic gadget in his hand. Pasco had forgotten he was holding it in his thick fingers. The device offered a translation of the word he had given, and his blood ran cold. Shahiden. Arabic. Noun, it read. Martyr. Noya began to speak.
I think there's something.
The wet gasp the boy gave was the last thing Pasco Abello heard. One moment there was nothing but a sea of red-tiled rooftops, and the next a grey, black blossom of haze and debris filled the optics of the binoculars. Jadid let them drop just as the sound shock of the explosion crossed the two-mile distance to the balcony, buffeting him as it passed, rattling the tall windows. He closed his eyes and visualized the effect of the weapon, almost basking in the thought of it. The first blinding flash of the detonation itself and the ring of compacted air radiating out to the interior of the police station, glass and plastic shattering under the catastrophic overpressure. The bodies of those closest to the ignition point would have been destroyed utterly. Blood would atomize into vapor, flesh becoming cinders. Supporting pillars and walls would distend and crack, ballooned outward by forces they were never meant to contain. In a few microseconds, the building would break apart and begin to die. The structure would collapse under its own weight, the discharge churning outward in thunderous torrents, channeling destruction into the surrounding streets. He opened his eyes. Behind the rush of the blast noise came a shrieking machine chorus of honking horns and bleating sirens as every car alarm within a mile radius went off at once. In the cool evening air, there was no breeze to stir the motion of the pillar of smoke that spiraled upward. It hung like a great black dagger pointing into the heart of the ruin. He waited, straining to hear, and was rewarded by a long, low rumble that resonated in his chest, blotting out the chatter of the people on the avenue below as they struggled to understand what had just happened. A second, larger dust cloud projected itself into the air as the stricken building collapsed. Jadid couldn't see the station house from where he sat, but he could see the mark its demise left behind.
Broad dispersal, noted Kadir with clinical focus. There are fires.
Jadid wondered exactly how his superior was seeing that. A spy satellite or a drone, perhaps. He absently looked up into the darkening sky. The gas lines will... he began. But before he could fully voice his thought, the dull concussion of a secondary detonation joined the unfolding chaos. New streamers of smoke rose with the main plume, illuminated from within by gas-fueled fires. Jadid rose from the chair, gathering up the phone and binoculars.
I am satisfied, said the voice in his ear. The sample meets with my approval.
The last words sounded like they were being directed at someone else.
I am leaving now, Jadid replied.
But when he looked down at the smartphone, the display was static. The waveform signal a flat line. The countdown, frozen at zero. The phone went into his pocket, clattering against his prayer beads. He took the small case containing everything he needed from where it lay on the bed, securing the compact Beretta 84F pistol sitting next to it in a hip holster, which was concealed by the cut of his clothes. In all the noise and confusion, the sound of the Hilton's fire alarm shrilled away unnoticed as he left the hotel through the emergency exit and threaded a way between the people pointing and gawping at the column of smoke. 2. The interior of the warehouse was filled with sharp-edged shadows cast by skeletal yellow work lamps, surrounding a line of collapsible benches at the rear of a Renault truck. The vehicle was painted forest green, and it sat inert with the rear doors hanging open. Figures in black clothing moved around it, a ready sense of urgency in their motions. Mark Dane blew out a breath and turned away from watching them, shoving his hands into the pockets of his jacket, walking in a slow circle in the semi-darkness. The pre-dawn air was cold and damp, and he could smell the salt and rust of the nearby seaport. Through the grimy windows it was possible to make out the sodium-bright glow of the Dunkirk docks and the square hills of cargo containers along the lines of the wharves. Mark was wound tight with energy, already regretting the cocktail of coarse instant coffee and Red Bull that had been his morning eye-opener. Inside the jacket, his fingers drummed as he tried to find a quiet spot in his thoughts. It took effort. It was like this on every sortie, and every time he thought that the next time he would be free of the unease. But it hadn't happened yet, and the corner of his lip pulled up in a crooked smile as he considered that it probably never would. Mark's left hand went to his unruly shock of dishwater blonde hair and ran through it. He had a face that was young for a man in his late 30s, pale with it, and the dark clothes he wore made him seem rail-thin. He took another long breath and spotted Leon climbing into the back of the truck. Leon Taub was old enough to be Mark's father, but he was still fit and sharp-witted. Behind a pair of thick glasses, perched on an unlovely nose, there was an intelligence that had not been dulled by 40 years of covert operations in darkened buildings, wet alleyways, and harm's way. Taub saw him looking and gave a wan salute with the plastic coffee cup in his hand, disappearing inside the vehicle. Owen Davis followed the older man up into the truck. Davis's face was set in the continual grimace that was his default expression. Mark watched the dour Welshman survey the preparation area around the truck with a sour, judgmental air and looked away. The remainder of the team, the tactical element, were gathered together near the benches, and Mark picked up their dry laughter and the metallic sounds of weapons being made ready. Like Mark, Leon, and Owen, the others were all dressed in dark colours, but unlike his military surplus jacket and nondescript jeans, they wore black outfits of heavy ripstop materials and leather tactical boots. They sported vests studded with gear pouches, armour inserts, encrypted radio rigs and holsters. The group resembled an armed response team from some law enforcement bureau, but none of their kit sported agency sigils, rank, patches, or any kind of identification. Their equipment was an eclectic mix sourced from manufacturers all over the world, nothing bearing a telltale serial number that could be traced if it were to fall into the wrong hands. None of them carried the same primary weapon. The members of the group were variously armed with Heckler & Koch submachine guns, Mossberg tactical shotguns, or carbine variants of the workhorse Colt M4 assault rifle. The only common denominator was the cylindrical suppressor fitted to every firearm, enough to smother any muzzle flash and reduce the sound of gunshots to a gruff cough. Mark's own duty sidearm, a Glock 17 semi-automatic, was lying unloaded in the back of the truck, along with a custom-built laptop computer, remote surveillance console, and the rest of the tools of his trade. His operational role, a job that headquarters euphemistically designated as Forward Mission Specialist, meant that he wasn't expected to use a gun. But it was a requirement for all field-rated personnel to have some form of protection. Still, carrying the pistol on a mission always made Mark feel as if he was inviting trouble. Out in the real world, where normal people lived and worked, the group assembled in this vacant French warehouse did not exist. Mark Dane's world, with its guns and its secrets, was a dark, parallel reality existing alongside it, hidden in the long shadows. It was nearly 2 years since he had joined Operations Team 7, callsign Nomad, one of 10 rapid reaction units run under the covert aegis of the British Secret Intelligence Service. Long months since the headhunters had come, after his tour ended with the Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm. Months of intensive training and counter-terrorism and counter-espionage operations. Months of being a ghost to the real world. Mark Dane had dropped off the face of the earth, and this was where he found himself. He pulled at the cuff of his jacket to peer at the battered Cabot dive watch on his wrist, Mark's sole remaining connection to his naval service. An hour at most before sunrise. He nodded to himself and tried without success to shake off the last of the tension, which, despite his best efforts, had gathered in a tense knot at the base of his neck.
"Told you to switch to decaf," said a voice from the shadows.
He turned as she approached. Samantha Green was a head shorter than Mark's 6'2", but she had a way about her that made it seem like it was you that had to look up to her. She grinned at him from under the peak of a dark ballistic mesh baseball cap. Even with streaks of night camo on her face, her looks were striking.
"I'm cool," he told her.
"Oh, you wish that was true," Sam replied, not unkindly. She let her hands rest on the MP7A1 submachine gun hanging at her waist, sizing him up.
"Don't sweat it. We've done this 100 times before."
She nodded towards the rest of the tactical squad.
"Boss knows what he's doing."
The man she indicated caught her look and nodded back. Gavin Ricks was Nomad's mission commander on the ground, a decorated former Special Air Service sergeant, a stocky and well-muscled soldier with a boxer's craggy features and a shaven head. He gave them both a thumbs up and a smile that was almost fatherly.
"Yeah."
Mark meant that to sound convincing, but failed.
"Just, you know, be careful."
Sam gave a mock pout.
"Oh, that's sweet," she cocked her head. "Would you feel better if I gave you a cuddle?" "I don't know."
Despite himself, Mark laughed. Sam could always bring that out of him.
"Do you want to see?"
Her brown eyes flashed.
"Keep it professional."
She started to walk away.
"I think we're past that point," Mark added in a low voice.
Sam stopped and looked back at him. She had that expression again, the one he could never read.
"Job on," she said. "Job off. Don't mix them up."
"Sam," Mark frowned, groping for the right thing to say.
"I get it, but job on," she repeated,
all the warmth suddenly gone from her expression. The long night in Tunisia that had found them alone the first time had been months ago, but Mark still didn't know where he stood with her. Fraternizing within a unit wasn't supposed to happen, but if Ricks or the others knew something was going on, they didn't say. Sam was all about the moment, the rush of the now, and that was attractive to him. He knew that in the army she had served 2 tours as an explosives, ordnance, and demolitions specialist. She liked the taste of adrenaline. But Mark had no map with her. Sometimes he thought he had a read on the woman. In those moments when she was almost like a normal person, like someone with a real life. But then that cavalier streak of hers kicked in, and he was left wondering. It seemed like the only thing Sam was ever honest about, ever serious about, was the mission. Part of him knew he should let it drop, but Mark was stubborn, even as he could see her manner cooling toward him.
"Sam,"
he began.
"Sammy!"
The moments snapped as one of the men from the tactical squad strode over, calling out her name. Ian Nash was the unit's second in command, and he had the kind of swagger in his walk that Mark always connected with the tough kids he'd avoided as a teenager, growing up on a council housing estate in South London. Nash gave him a dismissive nod. He had a gaunt face framed by dark hair and a stubbled chin. There was a whipcord look to him, a manner that seemed coiled too tight for a covert operations specialist. But Nash was an accomplished operator, drawn, like Sam, from the British Army, cherry-picked by men in the upper echelons of the security services. Along with Rob Bell, who had been a copper with the Metropolitan Police's CO-19 Firearms Division, and a former Royal Marine named Bill Marshall, Nash filled out the part of the Op Team 7 that dealt with the sharp end of their assignments. Mark, Leon, and Owen with their information and on-site support crew, what Ricks called the blokes in the van, as opposed to the blokes with the guns. "Need a word," Nash told Sam, and raised an eyebrow in Mark's direction. "Tick-tock," he added, watching him. "Better get your toy box working, yeah? Almost kick-off."
"Right," Mark nodded after a moment, accepting the implied dismissal, and he began a slow walk back toward the truck.
He heard the mutter of a low, guarded conversation strike up between Nash and Sam the moment his back was turned, and frowned. Mark wasn't a fool, and so far he wasn't allowing his feelings for Sam, whatever the hell those were, to get in the way of the job, no matter what she might have thought. But there was something going on with the tactical operators that was being kept from the rest of the unit. This wasn't the first time Mark had seen Sam or Nash or Ricks take a moment for a conversation away from prying ears, and none of them appeared to have any intention of explaining why. He thought about Ricks's definitions. The blokes in the van, and the blokes with the guns. There was always going to be a gap between the support team and the strike element. That was a fact of life in this kind of group dynamic. They didn't tend to drink with each other after the fact, didn't cross over that much beyond the needs of the job, but Mark felt the distance more keenly than he wanted to admit. He could have been one of them. The MI6 recruiters had offered him the chance to apply for field officer status in the OPTEAM program, but he had let it pass. All this time afterward, and still he wasn't sure what had stopped him. He had said no, chosen to play it safe, and not to take the risk. Mark looked back at Sam as he climbed into the truck. She was nodding intently at something Nash was saying, and didn't seem to notice him. Talia Patel had not slept in the past 16 hours, but she would be damned if she was going to let that show on her face. Stealing a yawn inside the confines of the empty elevator, she pulled at the rumpled silk blouse under her Prada jacket, standing straight as the door opened. Exiting on the operations floor, she crossed through the security checkpoint, touching the smart card in her hand on the RFID scanner in the wall. The armed guard at the monitor waved her through, and she walked as quickly as decorum would allow toward the room designated as Hub White. Branching off every 50 feet along the length of the corridor were doors with digital displays hanging at eye level. Some were dark, others lit with text showing that the rooms beyond were secured or standby, and in some cases in a state of lockdown. If you ignored the guard with the gun, the unremarkable look of the place resembled the same kind of business space that existed in dozens of office blocks all across the City of London. But this corridor was 200 feet beneath those streets, deep in the sublevels below Albert Embankment and the glass and stone of Number 85 Vauxhall Cross. This was the factory floor of MI6, Great Britain's secret intelligence service, where the task of ensuring a nation's security went on around the clock. Despite the early hour, the building was busy. The work at MI6 did not follow the usual rules, something that Talia had come to learn the hard way as senior intelligence analyst for K-Section, the command and control division in charge of field operations for the OPTEAM program. She hesitated, discreetly checking her reflection on the surface of the book-sized digital pad she was carrying. Her sharp but not unattractive features were framed by straight black hair hanging to shoulder length, hazel eyes in a tawny face. Talia was satisfied. She looked professional and, above all, awake. At the door to Hub White, she gestured once more with the smart card, this time following up with a 4-digit day code on an input keypad, and the magnetic locks opened with a quiet thud. Talia entered, passing through a second sound-deadening door before she found herself on the raised gallery that ringed the busy operations centre. In a nod toward the classic design of a theatre, the gallery was nicknamed the Circle, while the level 3 steps down was the stalls. An open space lined with digital map desks, communications panels and computer monitors. Above it, hung large screens layered with signal feeds from dozens of data sources. The size of a tennis court. From this small nerve center, K-section were equipped to run an active mission anywhere in the world. At present, every system in Hub White was directed towards the port of Dunkirk across the English Channel. All monitor stations filled. All screens active. Talia stepped down into the stalls, catching sight of a weather map of the French coastline. It had been a cold, moonless night, and the nearest front of rain clouds wouldn't arrive over the coast until at least mid-morning. She found Donald Royce at the map table. The flat display resembling a desk strewn with documents, only here, the papers were actually virtual panels that could be moved around and manipulated by touch. Royce was engrossed in one of the panes of data. Her superior was average height and slight with it, soft in his features, but possessed of a focus that could be directed like a laser when circumstances demanded. He was Eton educated, betrayed as such by his meticulous Middle English manners, and there was a dogged kind of intensity to him that Talia found intimidating at times. He looked up, peering across his frameless spectacles. "You're cutting it fine."
"Sorry, sir," she replied. "I wanted to make sure we had the most recent hourly reports from signals."
Talia handed him the data tablet. "Thorough as ever," he said, paging through the report with sweeps of his index finger, skimming the content with a practiced eye. The reports from the all-seeing information specialists at the GCHQ facility in Cheltenham were as thorough as ever. "Anything here we need to worry about?"
She shook her head. "Not a peep. Nomad's presence remains unnoticed as far as we can tell."
"Good to know." He handed the tablet back and peered at the map screen. Talia glanced at the mission clock on the wall. Two displays showing Greenwich Mean Time and the local hour in Dunkirk. They were less than 10 minutes away from the point where Op Team 7 would be given their final go or no-go command. Royce steepled his fingers, studying a still of the Palomino, a freighter of Turkish origins flying a Dutch flag. It had been docked at the port for the last 12 hours, and the picture showed it lying high against its moorings. Nothing of any bulk had been loaded on or off the vessel in that time, not even fuel and provisions.
"We are certain, aren't we?" Royce asked, in a subdued voice that only Talia heard. "You saw the capture from GCHQ yourself, sir," she reminded him. "Cellular trace from a known arms dealer. Along with signals intelligence from the web and our other sources, we have probable cause to commit."
She was businesslike about her reply, but both of them understood the import of what was about to happen. This would not be bloodless. Those sort of missions were not what the op teams were used for. "We have to be sure," he continued, because when the French get wind of this, we will truly be knee-deep in the murd."
"The DCRI are being monitored," she noted, indicating a junior analyst working at a keyboard.
The analyst had one job only: to continually sift the communications feeds of France's domestic security service in real time, looking for any indication that the Direction Centrale du Renseignement Intérieur were aware of the covert operation taking place in their backyard. It had not been an easy sell for the senior mission director, getting the Prime Minister, the Joint Intelligence Committee and the Foreign Office to sign off on a red-rated assignment that would take place on the soil of an allied government, all without the DCRI's knowledge. Cutting the French out of the operational loop was a calculated but necessary risk. The data did not lie. There was a strong possibility that the DCRI had been penetrated by assets connected to the mission targets, and the plain fact was, this operation was too important to jeopardize. Royce suggested that it would be better to seek forgiveness rather than ask permission, and so the tasking orders for Nomad had been drawn up in deep secrecy. They would deal with any repercussions if they happened,
but the hope was that Op Team 7 would complete the mission under the radar and the French would never even know they had been there. Talia was confident that they could do the job. Nomad was a highly proficient unit. With their proactive mission mandate from the PM, Nomad and the other op teams had been instrumental in seeking out and neutralizing several Category A dangers to British national security interests, and tonight, the Palomino was at the center of just such a threat. Talia had known from the moment she had seen the news footage of the Barcelona explosion that this atrocity would come into the orbit of K-section. Terrorism in Europe was a cancer spreading without concern for borders or nation-states, and among the extremist cadres who claimed responsibility for the deaths in Spain, a name that rang a warning rose above all the others. They called themselves Al-Saif, the sword. Outwardly, the face they showed to the world was of radical Islamic origins, men sifted from the dregs of Al-Qaeda, the Soldiers of God and other splinter groups, but inwardly, they were a far more complex organization that MI6 were only beginning to understand, that extremist religion was only one part of. In their manifesto, they had threatened to kill a British city before the end of the year, not attack, but kill. They had used that exact word. And they were ghosts. Al-Saif had learned well the lessons of their fellow radicals, killed running to ground in the Afghan hills or destroyed from within through subversion. These were men equally at home building improvised explosive devices in Kandahar hovels or directing cyber-attack sorties from million-dollar corporate enclaves in Dubai. The development of the MI6's Op Team program was a direct reaction to such terrorist threats. British intelligence couldn't follow the men, so they followed the weapons. Al-Saif were agile and dangerous, but they were small and scattered. They needed a support mechanism, one large enough that it would not be able to exist without showing up somewhere. Royce was poring over the Combine file, his thoughts doubtless paralleling those of Patel. That was the name they went by inside Vauxhall Cross. Just the vaguest outline, the faint shadow of a power group on the edges of the global stage. Moving outside of issues like ideology and creed. Independent of national identity, motivated not just by money, but by some larger design that had yet to become clear. The weapon Al-Saif deployed in Barcelona was suspected as having come from Combine sources. They were in the business of brokering weapons, technology, and support capacity to terrorist and paramilitary groups around the planet. They were the armourers and quartermasters of desperate and ruthless men, and if Al-Saif were like ghosts, then the Combine were less than breath on the wind. "We've been tracking these slippery buggers for years," Royce said, almost to himself. "Tonight we've got a good scent." He stared at the image of the Palomino again, as if he was willing it to give up some new piece of information through the strength of his scrutiny. It represented a rare conjunction of events, the possibility of gathering new intelligence that would lead both ways along the chain of connection to Al-Saif and to their Combine partners. A fragmentary intercept of cell phone traffic had led them to this. The suggestion that the freighter's cargo was a weapon in transit from the Combine to a terrorist buyer. In the wake of the Barcelona attack, the Spanish Centro Nacional de Inteligencia were still picking up the pieces and had provided precious little results from their investigation to their European partners, a sure indicator that they had nothing to give. Somehow, an extremely powerful explosive device had been smuggled into a police station through a gauntlet of trained officers and state-of-the-art metal detectors without setting off a single alarm, and 100 people had died in the ensuing blast. If the Palomino was carrying a similar device, something invisible to conventional security methods, Talia felt a dull chill run through her. There were a dozen major cities within hours of Dunkirk, any one of which could be an intended target. Brussels, Paris, Amsterdam, London. She glanced at the mission clock.
Sir, they are in position. It's time.
Royce didn't look up. Nomad is green for go. 3.
Rules of engagement, said Ricks, scanning the faces of everyone in the back of the truck. Silent kit, weapons free, but zero local collateral if anyone comes looking. Some live captures will be useful, but that's secondary to the main event. Find the device and secure it.
It would help if we knew what we were looking for, said Bell.
The dark face of the taciturn ex-copper was tense with concentration.
If it was easy, they'd have the Yanks do it for us, muttered Marshall, his rough black country accent rising.
Let me guess. We'll know it when we see it. Right, boss?
You read my mind, Ricks replied.
Mark listened with half an ear, most of his attention on the screen in front of him. Cameras embedded in the bodywork of the truck provided him with a full 360-degree view of the exterior, and he scanned them for movement. Nothing. The port security patrol would not pass back this way again for at least another 20 minutes. Owen had brought the truck up to the docks, concealing it behind a low stack of freight containers. The Palomino was moored across the nearby wharf, lit by a few deck lamps.
It's quiet, he announced. Can you send up the flying saucer, maybe?
Leon threw him a look.
I'll give it a go.
He glanced back at Ricks, who nodded. Mark's slender fingers danced over the keypad of a compact portable console next to his laptop, and in answer there was a low thud above their heads. On the roof of the Renault truck was a plastic box that resembled an air conditioning unit typical for this kind of cargo vehicle. It opened, and a motorized arm silently threw a discus-shaped device into the air, which spun into the low breeze coming in off the water. The saucer was a small remote drone, the little brother to the unmanned aerial combat vehicles in use by most of the world's larger military forces. Built from super-light polymers and aerogel compounds, it could loiter over targets of interest for up to 20 minutes. A wireless transmitter sent the live feed from a micro-camera directly back to Mark's panel. Using a repurposed controller from a video game console, he flew the tiny aircraft over the dock in a long loop.
Nomad is green for go, said a voice over the general radio channel, crackling with the hiss of a signal scrambler.
Green light, Ricks announced, pressing his finger to the headphone at his right ear. Soon as we're ready, we go in.
Mark became aware that Nash was at his shoulder. He could almost feel the man straining to be let off the leash.
Nothing out there? He demanded.
Nothing, Mark began. But Nash was gone before he could finish, pulling up a mesh mask to conceal his face.
Deploy!
Snapped Ricks. And he and Marshall pushed open the truck's rear doors. In less than 2 seconds, the tactical squad were gone and the doors closed behind them. Sam was the last one out.
Game on, eh?
Owen made a show of cracking his knuckles and bent forward over his panel, losing himself in the lines of frequency strength across the monitors that listened in on radio signals and electromagnetic transmissions. Leon said nothing, the images from the screens reflecting in his glasses. Mark watched the group appear at the bottom of the drone's video display, and his lips thinned. He nudged the tiny thumbstick forward and flew the disc out toward the Palomino, scouting the route. Sam snapped open the MP7's foregrip and collapsible stock and pulled the SMG tight to her shoulder as she moved low and fast around a wall of blue cargo containers. Halting at the corner, she crouched and peered out at the Palomino. A single gangway led up to the ship, and on the deck she could see an indistinct shadow moving. A pinprick of red light glowed and faded.
Nomad 3, she whispered,
her voice picked up by the microphone pad pressing against her throat.
Got a smoker on the weather deck.
Mobile. Any others?
This is Mobile 3. We see two men on the bridge, reported Mark. Sam looked up in the night sky, trying to find the drone, but she saw nothing. For a moment she thought she could hear the faint buzz of the micro UAV's rotors, but she couldn't be sure.
No line of sight between targets, he added. Clear to engage.
Copy that. Ricks was behind her. Marsh, he's yours.
Copy.
Bill Marshall growled in Sam's ear, and she saw him emerge from behind one of the other containers a short distance away. The wiry ex-marine was fast, coming up to the foot of the gangway in a loping run. With a delicacy and grace surprising for a man of his stature, Marshall moved up the gantry in total silence. Sam flicked off the safety of her weapon and took aim as the red glow of the cigarette tip flared again, ready to open fire if Marshall didn't take out the guard. She needn't have worried. Marshall melted into the shadows just as the smoker leaned into the light to toss his cigarette butt into the water. There was the glint of light off an anodized blade and the guard went down without a sound, swallowed by the dark. A moment later, Marshall's voice was on the comm again.
All aboard the Skylark?
Ricks patted Sam on the shoulder and she threaded around the corner, moving swiftly toward the gantry. Nash was there a step before her, his M4 raised, and he led the way up. Ricks was at her back, and the last man on the ship was Bell. She glimpsed an untidy shape in the shadows under the flying bridge.
Get rid of that, will you?
Said Ricks, and Marshall gave a grave nod, gathering up the corpse.
Mobile 3 advisory. We have a single target emerging on the foredeck, Mark reported. Armed. Assault rifle.
Ricks didn't need to give the order. All the members of the tactical team found cover immediately, going silent. Sam dropped into the shadow of a lifeboat and chanced to look forward.
No visual, she whispered.
Same here, said Nash from close by.
He was leaning over an oil drum, the carbine extended before him.
Mobile 3, this is Nomad 2. Need a better steer than that, yeah? Do your job.
Wait one.
Mark's channel cut for a moment, and Nash turned toward where he knew she was hiding.
What's your boyfriend playing at?
He asked, isolating the mic so his words wouldn't be broadcast to the rest of the team. Sam did the same thing.
He's not my boyfriend. What is this, junior school? Grow up, Nasher.
There was a crackle and Mark's voice returned.
Nomad 2, he's coming to you. 3 seconds.
Nash nodded to himself and flicked a switch on the side of the M4. A diffuse blob of shadow moved at the edge of Sam's vision, lost in the gloom. She watched him track in the approaching guard and pull the trigger. The M4 chugged, and a spray of dark liquid haloed the air for a brief instant.
Target neutralized.
Nomad 1 confirms, said Ricks, emerging from his cover. Any more for any more?
Nobody else up here, boss, said Bell. Could be below, watching the package.
Yeah, well, said the mission commander. Gift horse and all that.
Ricks shot a look toward the woman.
Sammy, you keep this deck secure.
I'll back her up, Nash broke in.
Ricks accepted this with a nod.
Right, Marsh, Robbie, you're with me. We'll sweep the cargo base first.
He beckoned them toward him.
Quick and clever, ladies. I'd like to be home in time for a full English. Do your job, snorted Owen, in a passable imitation of Nash's gruff tones. A thank you might be nice.
He had the transmitter on mute, so only Mark and Leon could hear him.
He's a little busy, you think?
Offered Leon. Owen's eternal grimace deepened.
Some respect is due.
He stabbed a finger toward Mark.
You could have just let that creep with the AK-47 walk up on them. And then what?
He mimed a pistol, his thumb the falling hammer. Without pausing for breath, Davis went on.
You know what Nash says? All that shit about our kit being the toy box, talking about us like we're in here playing Call of Duty all the time instead of, you know, contributing. They need us.
Who's saying that they don't? Asked Leon. You know what I mean.
Owen's brogue always grew thicker when he was annoyed about something, and that tended to be almost all of the time. Mark couldn't remember when he'd seen the Welshman actually smile.
Owen, said Mark, tapping his monitor. Focus, mate.
That got him an acid look.
Look, you may not mind, but I'm not the kind of man who tolerates that sort of thing, see?
The other man looked away.
Nash keeps it up. I'll have to sort him out.
Leon gave Mark a wan look over the top of his glasses and the two men shared a moment of silent agreement. Owen liked to talk about being a tough guy, making a big deal about his taekwondo classes and how he wasn't one to be easily cowed. But he always seemed to quieten down in the company of the tactical team. He was an excellent mission technician, but in everything else, he could only talk a good game.
You want I should open a private channel for you?
Leon asked mildly, reaching for the radio console.
Just you and Nash, for a nice chat.
He's not worth it,
Owen replied after a while.
You let it bother you too much, Mark told him. It's just typical alpha dog bullshit.
Leon and Mark had heard Owen's complaints on many occasions. The three of them had sat in similar vehicles under similar circumstances countless times before. Taub liked to joke that their workplace was just like any other kind of office environment, only with the added detail of changing scenery and all the people with guns. Mark wished he could duplicate the older man's casual attitude. Leon had a seemingly bottomless well of stories that stretched back to MI6's glory days in the Cold War and a laid-back, old-school skill set to match. Owen muttered something under his breath and glared at his screen. A schematic of the Palomino, copied from the vessel's insurance files held by Lloyd's of London. Overlaid across the image were blue dots, each designating the location of an op team member. Two were static, while three were moving swiftly toward the bow of the ship. The Welshman leaned in, suddenly all business.
Nomad 1, Mobile 2, be advised. Satellite reads low-level thermal bloom on the deck below you. Could be a generator or a crew compartment.
Nomad 1 copies, Mobile 2. Proceeding.
Bell dragged the second dead guard to the gunwale and slipped him over the side with barely a splash. The assault rifle went next, as Marshall levered open the hatch in the foredeck with Ricks covering him, the black shape of his tactical shotgun aiming down into the hull spaces below.
Clear, said Ricks.
Bell stepped past, taking the ladder down with his MP5 SD3 submachine gun in his grip. Beneath the weapon's integral silencer was a flashlight, and he panned it around the dim interior of the corridor. Without looking up, he beckoned the others, and they joined him in short order. Bell aimed his torch beam at the walls, highlighting patches of rust and other signs of general neglect.
Doesn't look like upkeep is a big deal on this tub.
Ricks pointed ahead.
Move, he told them.
The three men began a swift exploration of the deck, moving aft down the narrow corridors, staying in a loose cluster. The close confines of the ship's spaces could turn any compartment into a death trap if a firefight broke out. All it would take was one alert crewman with an AK-47, and the mission would go loud and bad very fast. The corridor split into a T-junction, one branch leading to a closed hatch, the other to one that hung open. The low mutter of a television reached them, and Bell dropped into a crouch, signalling for Ricks and Marshall to halt.
He sniffed the air, like a hunting dog.
Bell smelled cigarettes and the odour of cooked meat. He peered around the lip of the hatch and saw an open door in the corridor beyond. Blue light reflected from a screen, and as he considered the situation, the TV speaker gave off a rush of laugh track noise. Voices inside the room joined in.
Maybe they want to share the joke, whispered Marshall.
Ricks threw Bell the nod, and he was at the door in three quick steps. He went in high, panning the MP5 across the makeshift common room. He didn't need to look back to know that Ricks was covering him with a silenced Mossberg. There were three men in there,
all of them swarthy and unkempt, all in dirty bluish overalls that suggested they were part of the maintenance crew. But the pair of assault rifles propped up against the wall seemed to give the lie to that. Two were seated on a decrepit old sofa before a blurry portable television. The other was on his feet at a small stove.
"All right, lads," said Ricks in a conversational tone.
The man at the stove reacted first, dropping the pan of soup in his hand and snatching the butt of a heavy-framed revolver in his belt. Ricks's shotgun made a sound like a can of stones thrown against a wall, and the errant cook was blown back into the bulkhead, a bright blossom of red across his chest. The others were shocked into movement, and Bell's lip twisted as he fired a three-round burst that opened up a sucking chest wound in the closest of the men. The last of the crewmen made it to the rifles and then thought better of it, his survival instinct catching up to him just in time. Ricks stepped over the soup cook, still alive although not long for it, and prodded the uninjured man in the side of the head with the Mossberg's barrel.
"How many on the ship?" he asked.
"No," said the man, raising his hands. "No."
Bell checked the man he had shot.
"This one's done."
Marshall was at the door, glancing this way and that, his M4 slung and a Browning high-power pistol in his thick-fingered fist.
"No one coming."
Ricks poked their prisoner with his gun again, reaching out to silence the television.
"How many men?" he repeated. "Where is the weapon?"
"No English,"
said the man, raising his hands to lace them together at the back of his head.
"You talk or you die," Ricks went on. "Last chance."
Bell held up a hand before the man, fingers spread.
"Five? This many?"
He opened and closed it twice.
10?
That got him a nod.
10. Yes. 10.
Marshall gave a grunt.
"Skeleton crew."
Ricks had an answer to that, but it was lost as the prisoner's hands blurred and came away from his neck with the bright arrowhead of the push dagger he had concealed in the back of his collar. The blade came down in a fast slash that cupped open the mission commander's right sleeve, biting into him even as he dodged away. The man screamed as he lunged at Ricks, intent on burying the dagger in his neck, but Bell was too quick, and the MP5 rattled off another burst. He let the weapon's recoil rise on its own, and the gun marched 9mm rounds up the stomach and ribs of the attacker. Ricks kicked him away, and the other man collapsed across the sofa, twitching as he began to bleed out.
"Fuck!"
He let the Mossberg hang free on its sling and clutched at his arm. Bell tore a bandage pack from his gear vest and handed it to his commander.
"That'll leave a mark."
"Piss off,"
Ricks spat, tending to his injury.
"So much for a live one, then."
A voice crackled in their ears.
"This is Nomad 2. Do you have contact?"
"3 targets down," Marshall reported. "Proceeding."
"Copy," said Nash. "Be advised, we're not seeing any movement up here. Where the bloody hell is everyone?"
"Where indeed," grated Ricks.
"All right, moving on. If the boat's empty, this should make our job easier."
Marshall jerked his thumb in the direction of the branching corridor.
"The other hatch leads into the cargo bay, boss."
"That way, then."
"Mobile 3," said Sam. "Mark, do you read me?"
She pressed flat against the side of a support girder, looking toward the aft of the Palomino.
"I'm here," said Mark. "Can you orbit the drone around the ship? Give us a read on the number of tangos. Something's not kosher about this."
"Mobile 1 agrees," said the voice in her headset. "Winds are picking up, so we're down on loiter duration. I don't think we can keep the saucer airborne for more than a couple more minutes."
She nodded absently. The breeze across the deck of the freighter was growing colder and more insistent.
"Do what you can."
Something fast and low blurred past overhead, framed against the grey haze of the oncoming dawn.
"He got anything?"
Nash called out, pitching his voice softly. He was crouched several feet away with a carbine at his shoulder, panning back and forth in a fruitless search for a target.
Still no reads, Mark replied. No targets on deck, I repeat, no targets. Nash made a sour face. Two guards patrolling and not another soul, that don't make sense.
No, admitted Sam. It doesn't.
You hold here, Nash told her, rising to his feet. I'm going to scope out the seaward side of the ship for myself, see if they miss something.
The drone.
He shot her a look. Is a gimmick. I don't trust the kid's toy to give me intel. Nash moved away, melting into the shadows. Bell dropped back to the rear guard position, and Marshall took point, leading with his M4, steering himself along the suspended catwalks over the empty cargo holds of the ship. He panned the gun right and left, stepping carefully with his NVG goggles snapped down over his eyes. The white-on-green images gave everything a surreal, detached air, as if he was peering at some virtual world.
Unless they're shipping dead air and rust, there's nothing here, noted Bell.
Passing through the first two freight compartments, there were only echoing metallic voids and the stink of stale seawater and corrosion. But then Marshall had to remind himself that the weapon they were searching for did not have to be huge. The reports shown to the team during their briefing made it clear that the device used in Barcelona was portable, and Bill knew well enough that someone smart enough could fit a nuclear bomb inside a medium-sized suitcase, or a bioweapon in a vial the size of a fountain pen. Size did not automatically equal lethality.
We'll know it when we see it, he muttered to himself.
You what? Said Rick from behind, as they reached the hatch leading into the next compartment.
Nothing, boss.
Marshall leaned into the lever and the door clacked open.
Thinking out loud.
He trailed off as the hatch swung wide and presented the main cargo space. This one was a good three times the size of the first two, filling up the rest of the Palomino's hull forward of the bridge. What made him go silent was the unmistakable scent of human odours above the wet and the rust. Down below, in an area that normally would have been filled by hundreds of cargo containers, there was just one. A single green rectangle of corrugated steel resting along the line of the keel. Arranged around the front of it was a makeshift porch, built out of scaffold rods, ropes and tarpaulins. He spotted a few camp beds and a big plastic drum like the kind used to store rainwater for irrigating gardens. And there were people. Kids, really. Teenagers by the look of them. Maybe four or five, peering up at them with dirty faces. Their uniformly disheveled appearance made it hard to tell if they were boys or girls. They all looked utterly terrified, and small wonder, considering they were staring up at three intruders with guns, men rendered faceless and alien behind the bug-eyed masks of night vision gear.
What we got here? Bell broke the silence. People trafficking.
It's not nearly enough of them for that, Marshall noted, thinking it through. Recreational supplies, maybe. For the crew. Ricks cursed softly under his breath, flipping up his NVGs, and the other men followed suit. Marshall had been to Gavin Ricks's house for dinner once or twice, and he had seen the man's pride and joy, Callie and June, his daughters, sweet girls, the pair of them, and the absolute apples of their dad's eye. The youngest ones down there on the deck had to be the same age as Ricks's daughters, and Marshall only had to look at his mission commander to know the man was thinking the same thing.
Careful, said Ricks, finding the steep access steps that led down to the makeshift camp. Don't spook them.
I'm calling this in, said Bell, pressing his throat mic. Mobile, Nomad 5, we have civilian contact on board.
Mark's brow creased, and he leaned across the keyboard before him. Inside the hull of the ship, the radio comms were heavy with static interference.
Nomad 5, clarify, you mean the crew?
Negative. Bell's deep voice was firm. Could be prisoners. We're in the main hold. They've got them living down here. He shot Owen a look, but the other man shook his head. Satellite infrared isn't picking up anything.
Under some kind of cover, maybe, suggested Leon.
The Russian mafia use military spec diffusion material to line the boats they have for shipping in girls for the sex trade. Could be the same thing. Rix's words cut through the stale air in the back of the truck, and the mix of horror and genuine disgust in his tone gave Mark pause.
They're just kids,
he said.
All call signs attention, a new voice sounded, and Mark looked up to see a master transmit message on the communications panel. This is Hub White. Primary objective remains the priority. Locate and isolate the device. All other concerns are secondary.
Mark's throat went dry.
Mobile. Copies.
Copy, said Bell after a moment, and Mark could almost see the grim twist of the man's lips as he said the word.
Boss, hissed Bell from the gantry. We gotta come back for them later.
Ricks didn't look up as Marshall followed him onto the lower level.
I heard, he said. Just give me a bloody second.
Boss, Marshall ventured, uncertain what to say.
Ricks cut him off with a stern look.
They might know where the package is, Bill. We can't just walk on by.
Then, very deliberately, Ricks reached for his headset jack and disconnected it from the radio rig. Taking care to approach without any sudden movements, Ricks slung his shotgun over his shoulder and held up his hands, palms out. The youngsters gathered in a knot, almost as if they were trying to protect one another, and the sad, pitiful nature of the act made Marshall feel sick inside. Closer now, he could see the hollowness in their cheeks and the scars on them. Somebody had made a point of hurting these kids, and his grip tightened on the butt of his carbine in anger. The tallest of them was a girl. She had pale, brown skin that made Marshall peg her as Indian. But he was lousy with that kind of thing, and for all he knew, he could have been a continent or two off her point of origin. She brushed lank, black hair back from her eyes and came out of the group to meet Ricks.
You understand me? He asked her. We've come to help you.
Ricks smiled warmly, speaking in a gentle, friendly tone. There was a voice in Marshall's ear asking for a status update, but he ignored it, watching the girl and the other kids for any sign of threat. As horrified as he was by the conditions here, he was still a professional soldier, and he wasn't about to let his guard down. The girl reached out and took Rix's hand. She was crying, tears cutting wet streaks through the dirt smeared across his cheeks.
We'll take you somewhere safe, Rix was saying. We're looking for something here. You understand?
She nodded and pulled on Rix's arm, pointing at the container. The girl said something in a language Marshall didn't recognize.
Boss, Bell called out from the catwalk. This is not the time.
She wants us to see in there, Ricks replied.
He nodded at the girl, encouraging her.
It's all right, love. Don't cry. It'll be fine.
Marshall tensed as the kid went to the doors at the back of the lone container and pulled at the latch, her effort making it swing open. He had a sudden vision of what might be inside. More children, stacks of little corpses. Before Ricks could stop her, the girl disappeared inside, lost in the blackness. Marshall raised his carbine and thumbed the touchpad to switch on the torch slung beneath the muzzle. Ricks had a flashlight in his hand and was doing the same. Rods of light probed the dark interior, sweeping over a mesh of cables strung from the roof and the sides of the container walls, connecting back and forth like the work of a mad spider. The cables ended in blocky lumps of plastic that resembled engine parts. Ricks picked one and zeroed in on it. The box was glued to the interior wall with a fat plug of orange epoxy glue. It was the uniform khaki green of military technology, lined with a string of text in Chinese and a stencil of the international symbol for explosives. There were dozens of identical components all around them. Marshall's torch beam found the girl, where she stood at the heart of the wire web, a black plastic firing box in her shaking hand. A lead snaked away from the box and into the mess of cables.
Bomb,
he barked, his mind catching up with what he was seeing.
Shahiden,
said the sobbing girl, pressing down on the trigger button. The micro UAV's battery meter fell into the red, and Mark grimaced as the shuddering view from the onboard camera became unwatchable. He sent the saucer drone up high over the ship, hoping that he could squeeze the last few drops of power out of it before it gave up the ghost. The wind had worked the little prop engines harder than he had expected, and it had taken a lot of juice just to stay on station. Mark stabbed the auto-return key that would set the drone on a direct course back to the mobile operations vehicle, but he knew that he had left it too late. The drone would fall out of the air into the harbour channel and be lost forever.
"Boss," he heard Bell say over the open channel, "this is not the time."
The drone's line of sight spun lazily as it spiraled down over the deck of the Palomino. Catching the water, the deck, the sky, and for a split second, Mark glimpsed the very definite shape of a human being moving at the bow.
"Someone there."
He shot a look at Owen's screen, but the schematic showed no targets. The locator markers for Sam and Nash were both in static positions on either side of the ship, in cover and standing sentinel.
"I think we have movement on the..." he began.
Bill Marshall's cry alarm broke over him.
"Bomb!"
A crash of howling static screamed through the headsets of everyone in the truck, and a heartbeat later, the blast wave hit them. The explosive charges inside the container detonated as one, forming a perfect sphere of white fire that blossomed like a miniature sun. The detonation filled the cargo compartment, expanding in milliseconds to throw a firestorm into the ship's corridors. Everything flammable combusted immediately, walls of lethal heat-buckling steel. Streamers of fire spurted into the air, taking the path of least resistance. The Palomino was fatally holed at the waterline, the blast punching outward through the inner and outer hulls. Years of neglect heaped upon the old freighter, combined with the careful positioning of the device, broke open flaws in the fatigued frames. Cracking along her starboard side, Palomino immediately began a steep list toward the dock, spilling out fire and splinters of metal. Everything not lashed down juddered and slid across the weather deck as the fires from below took hold, spreading through the interior spaces to boil out of hatches and doorways. On the seaward side, a slick of burning oil was already spreading in a black halo, and acrid, heavy smoke turned in the air above. The depth of the dock was shallow, but still deep enough to swamp the freighter all the way to the flying bridge. Palomino's bow dropped as the ship sank into the grey water, dying by the second. Mark's heart hammered against his ribs and he felt dizzy, his blood singing in his ears. The interior of the mobile unit was a mess, panels hanging askew and monitor screens filled with rains of bright static. A wet mess of spilled coffee was everywhere, drooling from a cracked thermal carafe. Owen was kneeling, his face sporting a gruesome cut above his eye, and Leon lay on the floor cursing a blue streak in Hebrew as he tried to right himself. Mark lurched towards his console and grabbed at it to steady himself. The UAV controls were dead, the monitor showing nothing but the words "no signal" flashing red. The external cameras looked into a vision of hell. The blast had knocked down some of the stacked containers, one of which had broadsided the truck as it tumbled. But the view was framed by a wall of orange flames and black haze boiling up from the deck of the sinking Palomino. Panic and fear surged through him. Mark pulled at the twisted cord of his headset and dragged it back over his head, jamming the earpiece into place.
"Mobile 3, to all Nomad call signs."
He was shaking with the shock, and he pressed down on the sensation, forcing it away.
"This is Mobile 3. All Nomad designates. Respond immediately."
A hissing chorus of static answered him.